Justice Abrahamson joining us? Okay, please be seated. So before we begin on our second case for the day, my notes tell me we have students from Mount Horeb High School. If they are here, would they please stand with their teacher? Oh, terrific. You may be seated. The students are here in a program called Court with Class, so you all have had a little bit of a chance to look at some of the materials associated with the case that's going to be argued now before us. After we get done with the oral argument and the court is adjourned, one of the justices will come and chat with you a little bit about procedures in the court. Now, that justice is going to be Justice Daniel Kelly, but unfortunately he's not sitting on this case. He sits on the far left. But he's here. He was here for the case this morning. So he will come out. You don't need to be concerned. He's looking forward to talking to you. So if you stay a little bit after the case is over, he will come and chat with you about that. I'd like to now introduce the rest of the court to you. On my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Walking in the door, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, Chief Justice. Next to me, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and next to her, Justice Michael Gableman. So with those preliminaries, counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court, I'm James Carrig, and together with my partner, Robert Pisack, we're honored to appear before you today and to represent Associated Bank Corp in this proceeding. Today the court has the opportunity to confirm that pre-litigation jury waivers between private parties to contract will be considered in harmony with waiver under Article 5, Article 1, Section 5 of our Constitution, as that term has been defined by our rules and case law, law favoring arbitration clauses in contracts, and law regarding contract interpretation, including presumptions that go along with it. We advance that the approach of the Seventh Circuit in the IFC case is not at all inconsistent with Wisconsin law and, in fact, preserves our well-established policies in these areas. It preserves the recognized right of the parties of freedom of contract without governmental interference. It preserves public policy which encourages arbitration, encourages parties to seek out dispute resolution that falls short of a full-blown jury trial. That's equally applicable here when the parties have agreed to a much lesser surrender of rights. And finally, it advances the policy that you are presumed to know what you sign in a contract. When contract terms are clear, we presume that the party's intent is evidenced by the words they choose, if those words are unambiguous.
Counsel, when did you first realize that a jury trial had been requested here?
Well, the jury trial request is in the amended complaint and in the original complaint, Your Honor.
So you knew right away?
Well, it's certainly part of the record at that
okay.
time.
Okay.
Yes.
So you're held to know?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
So you're held to know. I mean, just like they knew that they had waived jury trial because it was in the note, right?
Yes. Correct,
and that's your position. They sign the note, they're held to know what's in the note, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. So you're held to know that they sought a jury trial initially, right? When did you object to the jury trial?
There were multiple conferences that are off the record, and it's part of the reason here, Your Honor. Counsel for the plaintiff in this case substituted in later in the case. This is one of the reasons why we believe that it is of utmost importance that the trial court be in the best position to assess whether or not there's been a delay that prejudices a party.
Why do we care about that? Why isn't you were here in the last argument? Why isn't this just a forfeiture? You didn't do it very quickly. It's gone. Why are we fighting about this? Isn't it 2 or 3 years before you objected?
Your Honor, the case was filed, original counsel withdrew, the court had originally granted a long extended period under which the jury fee could get paid. And our position is there's no dispute to be had until the jury fee got paid.
When was the jury fee paid?
It was paid in January of 2013, Your Honor, and the case was filed in May of 2011.
And when did you object?
The motions with respect to the objection were filed in after the status conference on April 16, 2014. It was certainly discussed at that time, Your Honor. It's our position that it was discussed prior to that off
that,
the record.
That was a year and several months, right?
A year and several months from the time of the payment?
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's the time you want to be considered. Because you don't want to get back to 2011. That's not in your favor. Right?
Well, Your Honor, it's our position that a demand in the complaint by a party that's not entitled to a trial is really a nullity. That it,
did
it
you
doesn't
answer?
Matter.
You did can't you revive the... Did you answer that? Did your answer say... No, you can't have a jury trial?
Our answer raised general defenses, including estoppel and waiver. So we would argue that, yes, that would be included within what we answered
but
in the affirmative defense.
But there's nothing specific in the answer
that
says
you're correct,
relating to the jury trial.
That's correct. That's correct. I think it's also important to note, Your Honor, that during that period, the court was dealing with a number of different things. And so... during the entire time frame that this case has been pending, there was a bankruptcy, there was a substitution of counsel. So the notion that the Court of Appeals rested on, that somehow Associated Bank had delayed this, is not supported by the facts in the record. The trial court directly addressed those issues and found that the bank had not delayed the proceedings. And as the federal cases that we've cited in our brief suggest, Your Honor, The Mowbray and Bear Stearns cases particularly, Your Honor, under the federal rules, which are always of importance and guidance for Wisconsin as we interpret our civil rules of civil procedure, objections to the jury demand by the plaintiff can be made right up until the eve of trial. And the cases explore why that's appropriate. And it's appropriate because the cases evolve. And parties may take different positions based upon the position taken by the other side. The trial court here specifically recognized that it wasn't until November that the plaintiff limited their claims to two
costs. What year? November of what?
November of 2012, Your Honor.
Go ahead. What did the trial court say?
I'm mistaken. November of 2013, Your Honor.
Yes.
When the pretrial reports were filed, that the plaintiff limited their causes of action to two claims. And one of the things the trial court appropriately recognized was that at that time, the case is changing. And so, of course, the defendant may take the position at that time that we are going to object to the jury trial at this stage.
Isn't your position you're always going to object to a jury trial here?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Isn't your position that you are always going to object to a jury trial here?
Well, our position in this case is that the plaintiff is not entitled to a jury trial.
Right. Okay.
So that's correct. But our view of Section 80501 is that it does not grant substantive rights. That
what doesn't grant substantive rights?
Rule 80501. That it doesn't grant substantive rights. For example, Your Honor, I don't think parties could agree by contract that an equitable case, foreclosure, for example, be tried before a jury. If that was in a contract, I couldn't come into court and demand a jury trial on the basis of an agreement between the parties. So,
not even an advisory jury?
I think that's up to the court. I don't think the parties can request that the court have an advisory jury. So by that, Your Honor, our point is that 80501 does not grant substantive rights. It doesn't do anything of the sort. And so if the court looks at it from an equitable standpoint, I think all the equities have to be examined. And the equities from the standpoint of the plaintiff have to be examined as well. And if they have forfeited the right to a jury trial by way of their contractual agreement, coming in and requesting a jury trial and paying the fee a year plus later doesn't do anything to revive that right.
Counsel, there's some parts of the record that bother me. Part of it is I think that there seem to be a lot of facts here that were developed at the Court of Appeals rather than in the Circuit Court. But essentially, there's enough allegations in the materials submitted to us that they're alleging fraud in the inducement of this contract. Okay? And that goes to the merits of the claim. There's also an argument that your former employee who has had other problems similar to this, prevented the plaintiffs from reading the documents they signed, prevented the plaintiffs from taking those documents to their lawyer, and basically stood in the way of what should have been their knowledge of whatever they read. I look at all that, and to me that feels like factual findings that weren't made in the trial court. But then there is something that seems to be undisputed, and that is that the bank made an investigation of your employee, and the court ordered you to give that investigation to plaintiffs, and you haven't done so. Should I then believe all the facts that are alleged in that one affidavit that the Court of Appeals seemed enamored with because you didn't do that?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the issue about the surrender of the bank's file and the investigation, it was decided by the court, I believe, after the appeal appeal had been granted in District 1. An order was issued after that time. We believe that order was issued in error and was not consistent with what the court's directive was from the bench. But at that time, there was no ability for us to go back and raise that in front of the trial court because the case was already up in the Court of Appeals. When this case goes back down to the trial court on whatever decision this court makes, it will be one of the first things we address. And we believe that surrender of that investigation file is contrary to federal law, and we would be, in fact, perhaps violating federal law by turning over that file.
Thank you.
And I would disagree, Your Honor, with the notion that fraud and the inducement is part of this case.
Well, I think that there are a lot of facts that are in that affidavit. I mean, if you get someone to sign a contract and you won't let them read it and you won't let them take it to their attorney, if that actually occurred, I think you got an issue that is a factual issue and that can be presented in the circuit court. It seems to me that's some of what the Court of Appeals seemed to rely on when they found the contract was unconscionable. Isn't that what they were leaning on, that affidavit?
Yes. It's the only evidence in the record, Your Honor, other than the complaint, admitted allegations of the complaint,
right, but
and the contract documents themselves.
Didn't this just go to the Court of Appeals on a single issue? Can you waive the right to a jury trial by contract? Wasn't that the issue?
I believe that.
And what all did you guys try to them? I mean, certainly their opinion goes way beyond that. Way beyond that.
Obviously. And our position, Your Honor, is on the unconscionability analysis, where the Court of Appeals looked at particularly the procedural side of the unconscionability analysis, we believe they improperly overlaid a factor on this court's prior decisions on that, and that was, we're going to look at the procedural context of when the documents were signed.
In order to have unconscionability of a contract, don't you have to have substantive and procedural unconscionability? Don't you have to have both?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. You need both. You need elements of both.
Well, was anything on that issue presented to the circuit court?
No. And unconscionability was never raised by the plaintiff at the Court of Appeals.
The Court of Appeals decision. Why I thought you all argued that.
Granted. It did come up at argument. Our position is that it was never raised by the plaintiff at trial court. It may have come up in the briefing at Court of Appeals. Trial court never considered unconscionability at all.
Did you brief it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the word unconscionability appears in the Parsons brief in front of the Court of Appeals, but there's no developed argument on it. It was not briefed. It was a surprise to us to have that in the court's decision.
All right.
Did you argue it? I'm sorry?
Did you argue it before the Court of Appeals?
I don't believe we argued unconscionability. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Court of Appeals decision reflects that we're going to address this because it may come up at trial. It was almost a preemptory look at unconscionability without an evidentiary record really at all.
Paragraphs 19 to 23 of the Court of Appeals opinion really are, I think, in part the gravamen of their response. And it is, what were you guys doing for 3 years? Whether you look at, I think it's 19 and 20 or 21, 22, 23.
Yes.
But they repeat that several times, that you offer no explanation. There's nothing in the record that you've provided to controvert the affidavit that exists. And so that's the record they are left with. You had the opportunity. You didn't respond to it. what did you do for 3 years? The Court of Appeals says it is unexplained and essentially unexplainable, and then they go on to further to discuss it. So what did you do for 3 years? You found out right away in the complaint that there was a demand for jury trial. The statute requires a demand for jury trial to be made before the scheduling conference. I think you don't have a problem that there was a demand for jury trial, do you?
No, there was a demand in the complaint.
Yeah, okay.
So it wasn't a payment of a fee, but there was a demand in the complaint. And part of our position, Your Honor, is there's nothing for us to debate until there's a payment of a fee.
Because let's say you're right. Okay. Then you had a 1 year and how many months after the fee was paid before you raised the issue?
Well, the timeline certainly speaks for itself, Your Honor.
I don't know. I mean, I'm really asking. If it is the payment of the fee that perfects the right, it was 1 year and so many, and it makes a difference if it's 1 year and 2 months, or 1 year and 6 months, or 1 year and 9 months. How many months was 1 year and what?
The jury fee was paid in January of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And these issues were briefed in front of the trial court in April of 2014, and the trial court's decision was 5 months later.
Okay.
And part of what happened during that time was a bankruptcy by the plaintiff. Okay.
So about 16 months before you raised the issue after it was filed. The Court of Appeals in paragraphs 19 to 23 talks about 3 years of preparation towards trial and how your opposing side here really is prejudiced of 3 years of preparation towards trial, and then at the end of 3 years you raise the issue. Were you preparing for trial too?
I was not at that time, Your Honor.
Okay, no, but
I was not personally the counsel.
Was counsel? Sure, looks like it that there was preparation for trial for 3 years.
Well, who took the bankruptcy?
I'm sorry.
Who took the bankruptcy?
Who took it?
Didn't someone file for bankruptcy during the pendency of this action?
Yes, that's what I was indicating.
Okay, how long did that take?
Taft Parsons filed for bankruptcy in August of 2013.
Okay, how long did it take before it got out of bankruptcy court?
The bankruptcy was dismissed in March of 2014.
Okay, thank you.
So, you know, during that entire time frame, the case was on hold to a great extent.
So then, if you would count the bankruptcy, so then how many months was it from the time of the jury filing until the bankruptcy started?
About 7 months, Your Honor. So, and I think to the extent the court is interested in that analysis of estoppel, that we have to look at it globally, and what is the right of the plaintiff here to claim a jury trial? Are they entitled to a jury trial? Why do they get the benefit of reviving that right somehow by either making a demand or paying a fee? Again, we think those two things are amount to insignificance, that they waived the right to a jury when they entered into the contract. And we can certainly debate about the circumstances of the contract. We think the trial court, in the position that the trial court was in, and knowing the facts that the trial court knew, the trial court assessed not just what happened at the closing table that day, but what happened prior to that. And we know that on the undisputed record that 9 months prior to that, the bank issued commitment letters, two commitment letters. In each of the commitment
letters. Neither of the commitment letters says anything about a waiver of a right to a jury trial.
Does not, Your Honor.
No.
It does not.
I read
it on. Says that in order to obtain the loan, as a condition of obtaining the loan, the plaintiff would have to sign State Financial Bank, the predecessor banks, loan forms. So we have 9 months between the time that they're on notice that if you want the loan, you're going to sign these forms.
But they don't know what they are. I don't see how that's notice of anything. I mean, if you presented the loan documents with a commitment letter, I would understand your argument, but I don't understand it since they didn't see them. So what does 9 months matter? They didn't see them.
I think what matters, Your Honor, is we've cited some of the secondary sources that talk about a jury waiver has become commonplace in lender documents, particularly.
That may be true. I mean, I don't dispute that at all. I just don't see notice. I mean, you were telling me they had notice. I don't see notice.
No, I think, Your Honor, you know, I don't want the argument to be misconstrued. The notice isn't that there's going to be a jury waiver in these documents. The notice is we are expecting you to sign documents as part of this transaction. 9 months go by. There's no allegation that the documents are requested. There's no allegation that counsel is engaged.
Did you give money to them during that period of time?
They drew on the first loan, the home equity line of credit.
Did they sign for that home equity line of credit?
They did.
Okay, and there's no jury waiver in there,
there's
is
not.
There? Okay,
there's
right.
only a jury waiver in the second document.
It's in the commercial debt, in the commercial promissory note.
In the construction note, Your Honor. Yes, yes. The jury waiver's in that document, and it expressly...
Okay, so you didn't give them any money on the document that you're saying they should have had notice there was a jury waiver in there, right? Didn't get any money on that till after that document was signed.
I would agree we did not advance any funds until after the documents were signed. It's not the position of the bank that the Parsons were on notice that there would be a jury waiver in those documents.
Okay. All right. That's what I was
talking. What we advance is that commercial parties, this is development, and I know that the WBA had indicated that Mr. Parsons was a developer. I don't think that's a dirty word. For purposes of this transaction, he was, and he is a developer. And Wisconsin courts certainly recognize that business parties, when they enter into business contracts, are held to a certain knowledge as to what is in the documents.
Well, if it's presented to them, they are held to know what they were presented with if they signed it, right?
That's right.
Okay. But that doesn't have anything to do with notice. That's what's bugging me, is the notice.
Well, I don't think there's a, I don't believe that there's a requirement, Your Honor, of notice in that context.
Okay.
The documents are clear. I think the Court of Appeals referenced that they had trouble with the notion that there were 30 pages of documents dropped on them at a closing. I think it's 26 pages. I don't want to split hairs on four pages. But when you talk about a commercial transaction, Your Honor, 26 pages, in our view, is not a lot of documentation. And certainly, to the extent that parties wish to have those documents before, they are generally provided. So we don't see any issue with that at all, that the trial court appropriately put it in its entire context, not just a context of what may have happened that day at closing. And we've indicated to the court that we're troubled by the notion of that there is an allegation in the affidavit that the documents are to be signed soon, they're to be signed immediately. The Parsons have come up with a somewhat elaborate explanation as to what those two things mean, and we actually think that explanation favors the bank. That if several weeks before the closing, the officer said...
Did the trial court make any of these findings that you're telling me?
Oh, I think the trial court certainly made the findings that Mr. Parsons is sophisticated, he's educated.
Where is that? That's in the record as a finding of the circuit court?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Well, I should say this, Your Honor. The circuit court issued a decision and order.
Yeah, that I read.
Yes. He makes the findings that he is an educated, intelligent person who has run his own engineering business and certainly must be versed with the notion of entering into contracts.
Right. But
Court of Appeals took issue with that.
He doesn't make any findings about him having the documents in advance or knowing what would be in the documents or anything like that.
No.
And he doesn't make any findings about his not being given the opportunity to read them or consult with the lawyer either, does he?
No, but the trial court was certainly aware of what the allegations in the affidavit were. Mm-hmm. And I think this also lands on presumptions. And the trial court properly applied the presumptions that apply with respect to contract analysis. And we think that's really at the crux of IFC, is we don't toss contract analysis out the window when we do these things. So when a contract is signed and the language is clear and it's unambiguous and it's not complicated and it's in capital letters inches above your signature, that matters.
Counsel?
Yes.
You're giving now some of the argument that I am focusing on in my thought processes, so I want to fashion the question to get at this more. You were present during the last oral argument, I believe, and you talked about line drawing. That's what courts do oftentimes, and balancing public policy. Earlier in your argument, you advanced about, you know, the public policy of contracts and people entering into contracts.
Yes.
We also have a public policy. I look at this courtroom and I kind of smile because the public policy on the other side of the waiver of a jury trial pursuant to contract is set forth in these murals here. Magna Carta, signed 1215, giving the right, that's where we get our right to jury trial. Trial back there, a Roman trial, right? Trial here, this was a jury trial, this is after the jury trial. And so certainly, you know, we talk about the foundations of our law, and we're surrounded by these murals that herald the importance of the jury trial. So tell me why, under the facts of this case, the contract, under the facts of this case that we have before us, the contract should outweigh the right to the jury trial.
I don't think it's the contract outweighing the right to a jury trial. I think it's the agreement of the parties to decide on a forum that's something other than a full-blown jury trial.
Okay, that's what I meant. Thank you. The contract provision that under the facts of this, and I say under the facts of this case, that arguably waived a jury trial. Why, under the facts of this case, that contract provision should outweigh, you know, the right to a jury trial, as we see heralded here in this room.
Sure. One of the things that the Seventh Circuit recognized in IFC, Your Honor, was that oftentimes parties agree that they would rather have professional adjudicators rather than amateur ones. And I think that is something that should be considered, and particularly in light of our existing law, decades of jurisprudence on arbitration.
Marry that to the facts of this case, then.
In the facts of this case, Your Honor, we've got a party seeking to develop land and sell it and make a profit commercially. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the backdrop of what this case is. It's not a consumer case. It's not like Brunton. It doesn't arise under the Consumer Act. This is an intent of a party to enter into a contract for profit. They enter into the contract. There's no question that there's a signature on the contract. The contract contains clear, unambiguous language. We are completely in agreement that to the extent that there is duress, unconscionability, whatever else, those contract provisions, those presumptions would all continue to apply and are all available to the plaintiff, just in a forum and in a situation that it would be without a jury. So those are the facts, Your Honor. And the facts are such that this would put private parties, banks, lenders, manufacturers, doing business on a commercial level in a position of having to do what would amount to a civil colloquy with anybody who enters into that contract, and it has a jury waiver in it. The language is clear. It's in the document. In our view, there's not, there under contract analysis, there would be no duty, no obligation on the party to provide the documents in advance, to escort them through the documents, to show things. So in our view, all we need is contract analysis to look at that against the backdrop of what we've got by way of what we already recognize in arbitration jurisprudence, that we favor this. We favor arbitration. We favor the parties to seek out an alternative other than jury trial. And the Court of Appeals has taken that presumption and shifted it back 180 degrees the other way, that now the presumption on a waiver of a jury trial is against. And that simply doesn't make any sense. So,
well,
hopefully that answers your question.
Well, it didn't marry the facts very well. I thought you were answering the question of whether the first threshold question of whether a jury trial is waivable. I was focusing on the facts of this case, but I will just stop there.
Right.
Fine. Can I answer that?
No, I think you've done a good job.
Okay.
It's now a time for Mr. Parsons' counsel.
When you get back up, I want you to talk about what remedy you want here. I have read your brief on page 42, and what you want to do is affirm the trial court's decision, but I want to know on what basis.
Your May it please the court, counsel. I think I was very pleased to hear some of the questions coming up here. Let me first address the fact-finding and the lack thereof. And as I recall, at the Court of Appeals argument, there was some lament as to the lack of development of facts.
Right.
We have been trying to get facts desperately for years. We have a motion to compel on this investigative report. That matter was argued legally, this defense that, well, would be contrary to federal law, and rejected. There is an order to compel out there right now that would have a lot of facts that would help us. The perpetrator of this, the bank employee, Aaron Moser, who was subsequently indicted and convicted of bank fraud, asserted his Fifth Amendment privilege to almost every question I gave him, rightfully so. And in those questions, I asked about the $30,000 HELOC loan, the home equity loan.
Can I just stop you for a moment? Is this in this record?
About him taking the Fifth? I think so, sure.
Okay.
I think that's in there, and the indictment's in there and everything else. Yes.
Was the home equity loan $40,000?
It was $40,000, but to be clear on that, he had $10,000 existing on the old loan.
Okay.
So he just paid off the old one, so it's really a $30,000 loss.
That's
why I call it a $30,000 loss.
Okay, thanks.
And I think it's important to know the facts of this case because this is not a contract case. We're here talking these lofty contractual terms. This is a quasi-criminal, if not actual criminal case.
But we can't get there. That's a matter for the trial court, if that's what it is. The only question that I want to focus on is, can you, not maybe did you, which I think is a different thing, can you waive the right to a jury trial by contract? Okay, that's a question that covers a lot of things. If I say, did your client waive the right to a jury trial by contract, then I get into all these things that to me sound like facts. Unconscionability. Where's the facts for substantive unconscionability found by the trial court?
Well, I mean.
So I'm interested in, can you do it? You waive it?
So let me respond to that way. I don't know that we can divorce entirely the facts. Certainly those that are in the record, that's all we've got. The affidavit and the pleadings, that's all we've got. And not through any dereliction on the plaintiff side attempting to get discovery.
I don't think anyone's arguing, but maybe we can just shortcut this,
yeah.
Because I don't think I'm alone, and I think everyone on the bench is under the impression we took this case primarily for the question of whether one can waive their right to a jury trial. And are you disputing that?
Well, perhaps. I would ask, I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. I would ask the court to merely follow the statute, 805.01 subs 1, 2.
You can follow anything you like, but the question is, can a party waive their right to a jury trial by a written contract?
Provided, yes, they can.
Okay,
they can do
good.
That.
We're on agreement.
They can do that. Is I would prefer that the court adopt the Wisconsin Association of Justices argument that, especially in these troubled times with all these, we've had witnessed in the recent presidential campaign, we need some moorings. The Constitution is one of them. And when the Constitution says the right to a civil trial is inviolate, I think that would inject some sanity and some sensibility into our society, much needed at this point in time.
So then arbitration is out the window?
I mean, no,
you don't get a trial if you've agreed to arbitrate.
In a manner prescribed by law. The Constitution says it shall remain inviolate except as prescribed in a manner prescribed by law, which the legislature has weighed in on. The legislature has adopted that. Chapter 788, absolutely. It's not unconstitutional. It's perfectly fine. And I think when you say that, Justice Gableman, the limited exceptions, like in the IFC case, they rely upon. These are two powerful companies sitting down, meeting with each other, not only choosing a forum, a law, they're affirmatively choosing. So by its definition, that waiver is contracted for and desired. By definition, it's very reading. In this case, and I think one of the reasons the court found the unconscionability, because this is a criminal case in my mind.
Well, but that,
it doesn't matter.
That,
we're not
that gets
there.
To the heart of your argument. And I think that actually, to use Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's phrase, that kind of marries the facts as you would like us to take them to the law of this case, which is what I'm getting from your argument is, yes, you can parties can waive, hold on, please. Parties can waive their right to a jury trial. They just can't do it under the facts as we think they exist, we being you, think they exist in this case where there was a fraud perpetrated on our client for the various reasons that are listed. I think that's your argument.
It is. Okay. That is, and I don't think it's inconsistent to say then we need a standard that when somebody asserts that their constitutional right was violated, that there be some brief mechanism. A colloquy, as we do in criminal cases, perhaps, but certainly the person that asserts the jury waiver has the burden of proving it if the other side objects to it. I don't think those are two inconsistent things. And then I think we can also look at the reality of the real world. If two companies sit down and their lawyers come out an agreement like they did in IFC, and they choose a law and they choose a forum and they choose an affirmative bench trial, not just mediation or whatever, I think it would be a frivolous argument where one of them come in and say, hey, we didn't contract for this thing.
Sure.
But in here, I think the unconscionability goes to the Court of Appeals. Look at the language of this thing. Anything related to this document, would that mean a slip and fall in the lobby on the way out? Of course not. And so on the other side of that, then, a fraudulent deprivation, a introduction into a trio of criminals, I know you don't like that word, but it's just so palpable.
Just to be totally candid with you, I think somehow what happened here is the expectations of the party, you in particular, got mixed up with the reality of why we took this case. And I think you had the understanding, and are operating under the understanding that we are going to get into significant fact-finding of and sorting through details of what may or may not have happened in this particular case, when my reading of it, I can only speak for myself as one member of the bench, but when my reading of it is we took the case for a very different reason, which is sort of a 36,000-foot reason of a general question, which the Chief Justice started out by articulating in her first question to you, which is, may parties contract away their right to jury trials? And you've already answered it, and I don't know how to, I'll just stop and let you go, but I just want to, I'm giving you a gift of candor right now that you might as well know what I know about.
Yeah, fine. And I think I agree with that, but I don't think what's inconsistent with that is a mechanism, as outlining the Court of Appeals decision, that if somebody disputes that, it's not some written as some sacrosanct thing that can never be discussed and never touched. And I don't know if that's...
I don't recall hearing myself say that, sir. Okay, but that's
So and we can look at, we have the legislature weighing in on this under 80501.
Yes.
And we know from a plaintiff's perspective, we've got to get the jury fee in and the jury demand in. This is in the trenches now.
Yes.
But also then, if somebody else asserts a mode, they have to assert it then as well, too. There's nothing unfair about that. The forfeiture here, the Court of Appeals discussion about forfeiture and waiver, I think is very appropriate here. There's both. It's a year and a half, 2 years, going on 3 years. Okay. In terms of the delay on the plaintiff's side from the filing, I came into this case in May or so of 11, we amended May of 12, and there was a stipulation with the bank for an amended pleading, a new scheduling order, and according to the new one, we filed the jury fee as required under the jury, under the new scheduling order, within the 30 days or whatever it was in January, we filed it. So,
counsel, what about the language in the contract of no waiver by the lender, that any waiver by the lender would have to be given in writing and signed by the lender? Would you have us not apply that contract language either?
I think under the facts of this case, I think were there to be more of a fact-finding hearing down at the circuit, at the trial court level, to adduce more facts, perhaps. But I think we have to go back to the constitutional requirement that the right to a civil jury trial remains inviolate, except in a manner prescribed by law. So I don't think parties should be able to contract around the law.
Doesn't the law allow parties to contract around, including the Constitution, but also statutory provisions?
But I don't know so much about a procedure in a trial court, like a court of equity. I don't know that two parties, I suppose they could assemble their own jury and an equitable claim of some kind and contract for that. I haven't really thought that through. But this goes more directly to the court, and I don't know that you can contract around a court or legislative provision. I mean, can you contract and say this law will not apply to us? I don't know that you can do that.
Well, in the UCC context, certainly there's plenty of law that allows the parties to contract around the UCC, and that serves a gap-filling function, doesn't it?
Maybe. I'm not that familiar with the UCC. There might be a provision within the code that says, you know, subject to the agreement of the parties or something.
Is your argument the only way you can waive the right to jury by contract is if there's something you can attach it to in a statute? Is that your argument?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Is your argument that the only way you can contractually waive the right to a jury trial is if there is some statute that you can attach the waiver to?
I think sometimes statutes, certainly procedural statutes, are important.
Oh, I agree with you. Well, is your answer yes or no?
Okay. I don't know that I understand the question. So I don't know that you can... what I'm suggesting is I think parties can contract. Two businesses can sit down and say, it's going to be very important.
And can they just do that, and you don't have to attach it to a statute? See, I understood your response to Justice Bradley's question was, well, sure, they can contract to arbitration, but then there's a statute about arbitration.
But then there'd be no dispute then. Within the scheduling conference, both parties or one party would say, "We have this is going to be a bench trial, Judge.
Counsel,
because it's in the contract."
Counsel, one of the issues, the first issue, I guess, that was stated that we took the case for was, can the parties to a business transaction in Wisconsin agree that any dispute between them will be resolved without the need for a jury trial? We've been talking about that a little bit. One of my questions to your opposing counsel dealt with the facts, marrying the facts to this case, and there seemed to be some concern about, you know, what are the facts of this case and involving fraud, conviction, etc. But another issue that we took it for was a basis of the Court of Appeals decision was the forfeiture of the argument, the equitable estoppel, essentially, for a three-year period of time. And the issue is thusly presented to this court. Did the trial court properly exercise its discretion to manage the procedure and timing to resolve the dispute regarding a jury trial? I think the Court of Appeals said the trial court was wrong with regard to that. Can you address that issue?
Yes. I think the trial court, after it was a three-year from the filing, 2 years, there was a bankruptcy in there that resulted in a two-month delay by some other counsel. And went to bankruptcy court, and that was dismissed because it was interfering with this. It was 2 months. And so when the trial court made that decision, it was with a paucity of facts. The law is the law. 80501 says you had to have asserted it, and they didn't.
Doesn't say they have to assert it. Where does it say you have to assert the right to a court trial in 80501? Show me those words.
In sub 2.
Well, read the words to me. I got the statute right in front of me. We'll read them together.
A trial in the mode to which entitled constitutes a waiver of a trial in such mode. Sub 2 says any party entitled to a trial by jury or by the court may demand a trial in the mode in which entitled matter before scheduled.
Okay. It doesn't say you have to demand a court trial. You don't even have to demand a jury trial. You can. If you don't demand it, then you're into the waiver in sub 3.
You should stand in front of the microphone.
Yeah, you have to be in front of the mic.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. That's okay.
I'm sorry. Sub 3 then says the failure of a party to demand in accordance with sub 2 a trial in the mode to which entitled constitutes a waiver of a trial in such mode. So they're saying
you want us to interpret that as requiring parties to demand a court trial.
I think that's what the legislature says. If they feel they're entitled to that mode of trial, they should assert it.
But they're not demanding a court trial. You're demanding a jury trial. There's a little bit of a difference here.
We're demanding a jury trial.
You are. But they aren't making a, they haven't made a demand for a court trial.
Their mode is for a court trial.
Well, maybe they could do something else. Maybe you could agree to arbitration. But what I'm saying to you is the statute applies to people that are making a demand for a particular kind of trial. You are. They didn't make a demand. They just said you can't have a jury trial.
What, under your logic, would happen in the case where someone doesn't pay their jury fee and no one demands a court trial? Does the case just get dismissed?
Right.
No.
What happens?
If somebody doesn't pay the jury trial, you'd bring a motion, ask the court to expand the scheduling order so that it...
Well, the court doesn't have to do that. People forfeit their right to a jury trial if they don't pay the fee. You don't, in a civil case, you don't get it for free. Right?
Were the court to deny that?
So under your logic, though, you're saying if no one has demanded a court trial and they don't pay the jury fee and the court determines they're not entitled to a jury trial because they didn't follow the order or pay the fee... Then you're saying there is no trial because there was no demand? Is that right?
I think that's parsing too much out of this. I think this is for everyone's convenience. And I mean, I don't want to guess what the legislature's saying, is we should know early on what's going on, how the case is going to progress.
I think the question is, what is the default mode of trial? Your opposing counsel asserts that it's trial to the court. Do you disagree with that?
Well, there'd be a motion before the judge for a new scheduling order to accommodate whatever trial is requested. And the court at that point would make the decision, is it a frivolous claim? I'm not going to grant this. It's out. Presumably, they'd give it some thought and decide, okay, yes, I'll expand it. You've got 30 days.
But what's the default if, under the scenarios the other justices have mentioned, it is feasible that each side asserting a right to a jury trial and the other side asserting a right to a court trial, both could not act on those rights and arguably waive those rights. So what is the default? What would the trial court judge do? Say the trial by jury is waived, so we're going to have a court trial, or vice versa. What argument do you make there?
I would suppose it'd be an appeal, and then there'd be some kind of review of the decision in denying that relief.
Counsel, the larger question that comes to my mind based on the questions and responses is, who is that statute directed toward? Is it directed toward the litigant in the typical case, or is it directed, as you apparently want us to interpret it, at someone who is attempting or wants to assert their contractual rights for a waiver? It seems to me that you're stretching it. Again, I'm being candid with you.
Yeah, and
it seems to me you're stretching it by asking us to interpret it as being directed towards a contractual situation.
And allow me to be candid as well.
Go ahead.
It is that it's rooted in the Constitution. So
what's that?
It's rooted in the Constitution. This is the mode of trial, the right to a jury trial, is a constitutional right.
Having been a judge in one form or another for over 14 years, I'm familiar with the constitutional right to a jury trial, counsel. What I'm simply asking you to do, which is your job today, is to convince, and I don't think I'm the only one on the bench who has a few questions, demonstrably, about your interpretation of the statute. So go ahead.
Well,
let's take a look at the statute. Sub 2. And sub 2 says, do you have a statute in front of you?
I don't have the actual one.
Yeah. That's 80501.
I got it.
80501 sub 2 talks about demand, and it speaks about two kinds of demand, I think, both a demand by a trial, jury trial, and a trial by the court. But let's see what it actually says. That's my interpretation. Let's see what it says. Any party entitled to a trial by jury or by the court may demand
a trial in the mode to which entitled at or before the scheduling conference or pretrial conference, whichever is held first. The demand may be made either in writing or orally on the record. It seems to me that this demand in sub 2 says entitled to a trial by jury or by the court may demand. So maybe I think your argument is that it says that, so that's what they're talking about. Now let's take a look at sub 3, waiver. The failure, and this is the one where I think you've received a response that, let me rephrase that. This is the one that seems to cause some concern. Waiver. The failure of a party to demand in accord with sub 2, which we just looked at, which deals with trial by jury mode and trial by the court mode, a trial in the mode to which entitled constitutes a waiver of the trial in such mode. Now,
well,
I
read the next sentence
before
you ask him your question.
Listen, I certainly will.
Good.
When I read that and I listened to your argument and the questions, it sounds I was surprised at your response that, yes, the beginning of sub 3 deals with the mode set forth in sub 2. Now, it goes on to say the right to trial by jury, so now we're talking about the jury trial mode, is also waived if the parties or their attorneys of record by written stipulation filed with the court or by oral stipulation made in open court and entered in the record consent, right, to a sitting without the jury. Then the final sentence is a demand for trial by jury made as herein provided may not be withdrawn without the consent of the parties. So that's the statute we're interpreting. I didn't mean to leave out sub 1, but I'm not really focused on that right now. So tell me what your interpretation is.
Well, my interpretation, it's not inconsistent with what we're saying. The failure, sub 2 says, by jury or by the court may demand a trial in the mode to which entitled. So they're saying it's entitlement.
What do you think entitled means in that context?
In the waiver, they've got a contract, they've got
okay, so it doesn't mean, what happened to your constitutional argument?
Well, then if it were, no, there would be a constitutional argument in that were the other side to say it was fraudulently obtained, then there would be a hearing.
So now the statute is solely directed at the contractual circumstance.
It says if you're entitled to the jury, you demand it. If you're entitled to a bench, you demand it. You put notice in
it.
Let
me put it to you this way. Just say I buy your argument, and they had to make a demand for a trial court, and you wanted a jury trial, okay? And you both make the demand. How do you figure out which one's right? Don't you have to just go back to the contract and look and see? So the contract controls, not the statute?
I think we go to the Constitution, and we look at that, and we look
at
the...
Well, the first section of the statute is the Constitution.
Because somebody would assert that. The language would be there, yes.
Okay, just say your parties read it, they knew what they signed, they just wish they didn't do it, and now you're in court, and you demand a jury trial. Other side says, you waive that, I'm demanding, which I don't think they're doing here. I think they're just trying to stop you from what you're doing. But in any case, I'm demanding a jury trial. If you both did that under the statute, you got to have it one way or the other. Isn't it the contract that controls?
Right, but then we would have the procedure outlined in the Court of Appeals decision. The person would say it was involuntarily, it was not knowing, and there'd be a brief a mechanism of some sort.
Well, that's your facts. I was just trying to look at it more generically. I understand that you think there are problems with how they got them to sign the contract. I understand that.
Yeah.
For my analysis, I need to put that aside because those are facts. I don't know whether that's accurate or not accurate. You may be absolutely right. And if you are, you'll take it to the trial court and you'll be vindicated at that level.
What do you do with 81461 sub 4 that discusses the jury fee? And it says if you don't timely pay the fee, then you have a court trial.
You have
how
a court
do you,
trial.
How do you, yeah, but when I just asked you that,
Because that's
you had a hard time answering that you get a court trial if you don't timely pay your jury fee. So now I'm directing you to that statute. Have you changed
Because
that
that's
answer?
A matter prescribed by law, and that's in the Constitution.
Okay, well then, why didn't you say that when I asked you that last time around? That's my question.
I apologize.
Right, because you said you either have to demand a jury or you have to demand a court trial. And if you didn't demand a jury or you didn't timely pay your fee, your only answer to me was, well, then you ask the court for an extension of time to pay the fee and then you appeal it. No, if the court decides you don't get a jury, you have a court trial.
I think in the manner prescribed by law allows the court's discretion to have a scheduling conference. And
of course, but if you don't follow the scheduling order, you can be prohibited from doing a lot of things, including introducing witnesses and doing all sorts of things that are fundamental to a...
That's correct. That's correct. I think what we look at the arbitration analogy that's being drawn here only enhances our argument. Those are manners prescribed by law that the legislature has written and has said these constitutional rights are limited this way. And so they've weighed in with 814, they've weighed in with 805. The legislature has weighed in on how we're supposed to conduct ourselves. And I don't think we should rewrite these statutes.
Well,
it very clearly says, sub 3, the failure of a party to demand in accordance with sub 2 a trial in such mode to which entitled constitutes a waiver of trial in such mode. They don't say jury trial.
Counsel, if I understand your argument, you said you agreed with the amicus brief.
Yes, yes.
And as I read the amicus brief and as I listen to you, it's your position that the Constitution, when it says as prescribed by law, words to that effect, it means as prescribed by law means statute.
It means statute.
And you get then to the statute, which tells you how you can ask for a jury trial. Right?
Right.
And you did follow the statute, right?
Right.
All right. So if you take that position and the court buys it, then whatever you do by contract doesn't work because the Constitution says prescribed by law, that means a statute. You followed the statute. The contract is a nullity.
Not necessarily because the other side would have made the demand in the timely manner under the statute as well.
Okay.
They would have apprised the court. I mean, I don't want to guess why the legislature wrote this, but they did it so people can organize early on what's going on.
So if you get to where both of you have done it by law, they ask for a bench trial, and they rely on, and they do it according to the law, and they rely on the contract. You ask for a jury trial, and you rely on making the jury request timely and paying the fee. Okay. Then you get to where who controls. Does the bench trial request control or does the jury trial control? And then the amicus brief says that if you get to that, then the question is, did you appropriately waive the jury trial? And that means a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver, right?
Right.
And that, so that would be the second stage, and that the contract doctrine is subject to the doctrine of waiver, forfeiture, and estoppel. Have I summarized the argument correctly?
I think so. Yes. Yes. And the reason I say I would adopt this as the fifth tier of requests here is that I think we've cited the In re Orange, the California case, the Georgia case, I think New York these are pre-litigation waivers are just unconstitutional, and there's no calamity in those states. There's no bankers. Look, most of these contracts are going to end up in a bankruptcy court. I saw one. I think the amicus for the Banking Commission said there's going to be a boondoggle for lawyers if they get. This is not the real world. These cases at $10,000-$20,000, no lawyer's waiting for this elaborate, expensive pretrial hearing to show waiver. If you look in Milwaukee County, where I come from, with the and by analogy, the personal injury cases, it's almost impossible to bring a $10,000 or $20,000 personal injury case to a jury trial these days. It is the insurance companies that are paying the jury fees. They want the jury trials, not the plaintiff's lawyers, on the smaller damages cases because of the expense, the cost. So there's no great incentive out there, boondoggle for lawyers, for some distressed person coming in with their $12,000 HELOC loan defaulting, saying, aha, we'll get around it for a contingency fee. They're not going to be paying the boondoggle fees they suggest in one of these briefs. It's hard work. The lawyer wants, if it's a good cause, it's got merit, that lawyer wants to get that case before a forum quickly and resolve it quickly to find out where they are. This is not going to be the burden, the calamity that they speak of. This is weighing a perceived. There's no statistics. There's no facts.
What about the economic consequences that were raised in one of the amicus briefs with respect to the pricing of these loan products for consumers or business or personal consumers?
I think it's just mentioned. I read that brief, and I saw very little legal authority, and other than broad statements, I saw no logical analysis, and there's no statistics.
I think it's actually very consistent with Judge Easterbrook's opinion in the IFC case, which I know you're advocating we not follow because it applied Illinois law, but Judge Easterbrook goes through the economic analysis of the consequences of this type of principle that you're advocating.
What about California? What about Georgia? I mean, we don't see any statistics going on down there. This is not the burden, I would argue, that's being proposed here. These are contingency fee cases. Most lawyers, the smaller cases, the lawyers aren't going to touch, and they certainly aren't going to look at it as a boondoggle, going through some expensive mechanism process. In the very rare case that somebody says, I've got a jury waiver, there's a jury waiver in there, but I didn't know what I was doing when I signed it. That's not going to happen. It's just not. And maybe in a bigger case like this, then it deserves the extra attention that it calls for. It deserves it's not a colloquy, some hearing, some showing before the judge, the trial court judge, that this was not knowing and voluntarily, borne by the person asserting the jury waiver. And I think that's consistent with the mandate of the Constitution. So I'm not saying contractual waivers of jury trial are improper. We don't have to go all the way there. I'd like to see that, but we don't have to go all the way there. If it's two businessmen in a room hacking it out, saying we're going to go to this court, use this law, yes, have a bench trial, yeah, that should be. And then if it gets asserted, it'd be frivolous. It would be frivolous if that gets asserted. And all we're doing, asking, is to follow the mandate of 80501, the legislature, and certainly not 2 years later. 2 years later, bring it up. First, I think the Court of Appeals' opinion is well-reasoned. It starts with the statutory. The legislature has weighed in. We do look at the Brunton analysis here. What I would phrase it even more strongly, if a mere waiver of a statutory right to venue or whatever it was requires knowing involuntarily, then certainly it should be fivefold applied to a constitutional right that's being waived. And in other words, a football analogy on that, a statutory right.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Your Honor, counsel. Waived in the manner prescribed by law. Critical words completely missing from the Georgia and California constitutional provisions. That argument is easily disposed of because those words just simply don't appear. They're critical in ours. Our approach to that is manner prescribed by law can mean statute, can mean common law, and certainly the agreement of the parties by way of contract is something that is enforced pursuant to our common law. Justice Abramson left me with the notion of what do we want?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
What we want is a court trial. We want the matter to be referred back to Milwaukee County for a court trial consistent with the agreement of the parties.
On what grounds?
On the grounds that the plaintiff has waived the right to a jury trial. And that waiver, I think this court can also clarify. Interestingly, the trial court cited IFC, but didn't really fully adopt the holdings of IFC. Why? Because the trial court then went into a knowing and voluntary analysis. That analysis has been done, and it's done based upon the three-page affidavit that the plaintiff provided. the trial court looked at, is the language conspicuous? Was it procured by fraud? And what is the sophistication of the parties to the contract? All those things have been reviewed and looked at by the trial court. So to the extent that this court sets aside IFC and says, no, Wisconsin law is not consistent with that, despite the fact of our argument of arbitration and the other issues, a knowing and voluntary analysis, to the extent that it's necessary, has already been completed by the trial court. So this court can remand it to the trial court for a court trial consistent with the agreement of the parties.
Okay, I didn't see that he made a finding it was not entered into by fraud. I see his findings that the waiver of jury was conspicuous and clearly stated and unambiguous, and the Wisconsin courts presume a party to a contract has knowledge of it and consented to its terms.
He certainly recognized the factor, Your Honor. I don't know as he went into an extended analysis as to whether it was procured by fraud, but what was in front of him, Your Honor, was the facts that are in the affidavit and the facts asserted in the complaint. And the trial court is in the best position to reasonably infer from those facts what the appropriate decision should be going forward. I believe the decision says, Your Honor, I'm not sure in what paragraph.
Yeah.
I believe he specifically references, was it procured by fraud, when he's analyzing whether or not the whirlpool factor should apply.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to read it again. I had read it before we came in today. I didn't see that, but I will look at that. But you'd never had an evidentiary hearing on the fraud question, did you?
No. There was no evidentiary hearing at all.
Okay.
And that goes to the issue of perhaps not knowing if something was conspicuous, maybe it's knowing, but the issue of voluntary. Were there any findings by the court on the issue of voluntariness?
I think the trial court's decision certainly infers that based upon contract analysis, the contract was entered into voluntarily. Why? It says it, number one.
I'm talking about a waiver of a right. So, I mean, the waiver of a jury trial generally is knowing and voluntary. And what has been referred to earlier is, you know, the writing is big, it's conspicuous, but what's lurking in the background here really is how voluntary was it, right? And I am asking if there was a finding of the trial court on voluntary.
I believe there was, Your Honor.
Can you point me to it? Or, you know, if it takes too long.
I can certainly try.
Okay, if it takes too long, just kind of generally. I mean, you're sure that there's a finding on voluntariness by the trial.
And is there a specific finding on that?
That's
no.
That's what I'm asking.
But I think, Your Honor, what the trial court did was appropriately looked at the complaint and any allegations that were admitted and the affidavit in front of him.
But along those lines, counsel, and the larger question that I think Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is getting at and I'm interested in, there would certainly be nothing inconsistent with the idea that parties can waive their otherwise constitutional right to a jury trial through the contractual means. And if we are not satisfied that the trial court has adequately addressed the issues, the very important issues, of fraud or voluntariness or anything, we can remand back to Milwaukee County for determination on those issues, along with the instructions that yes indeed, parties can waive by contract their constitutional right to jury trial. Yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Certainly, we would also indicate the fraud claim by the plaintiffs was dropped. That was dropped at their election. They could have continued a fraud claim and asked the trial court for an evidentiary hearing on the threshold consideration of whether or not the contract was entered into voluntarily knowingly.
Got it.
Now, we would also say, Your Honor, against our backdrop of arbitration jurisprudence, there's no need to demonstrate that. The need or the consideration should be what the IFC court considered and what our courts consider with respect to arbitration. Did the parties know that they were entering into a contract? If the answer to that is yes, they've agreed to be bound by its terms. This trial court appropriately was not persuaded by the affidavit that suggested that I wasn't given time to look at this.
Okay, counsel, thank you.
Thank
I
you.
Want to know what is the
red light is on.
I understand that. What is the effect that Carol didn't sign this loan agreement?
We've outlined in our brief, Your Honor, we don't think that that is of effect at all for several reasons. First is, this is the last document in the group. So the waiver here clearly waives the actions that have gone on up to that time. Second, there's really a partnership concept at play here. Again, this is property sought to be developed, sought to be sold by the parties, by the plaintiffs for a profit. And they have jointly entered into that venture, and one of the parties committing to that contractual agreement is enough. In addition, Your Honor, we would also note that Carol signed the mortgage. She signed the mortgage that is paired with the construction loan. So with that document, she's aware that there are other documents related to this, including the very simple two-page promissory note. We've argued that based on all these factors, she is in privity with Mr. Parsons and therefore should be considered part of the waiver as well.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, we are going to adjourn for a break. Justice Kelly will be out to talk to the students. If you can stay for a little bit, and anybody else that would like to stay. And so we will be in recess until 1:30 when we start our next case, and it's now about 1:30.